This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. It's time once again for our week in review. Thank you for joining us. Our panel of trumpet writers is eager and ready to discuss the important events of the week. We have here in the studio Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Always good to be on the show.
Via Skype from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And via Skype from our office in Jerusalem, we have Brent Noctegal.
Greetings.
In front of the United Nations building in New York, there is a sculpture of a man beating a sword into a plowshare, and it references the prophecy of Isaiah 2 of a time coming in the future when people will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. They're not going to learn war anymore. Well, in our first segment today, we're going to see clearly that that time is not yet here. As much as people may talk about the need for disarmament and weapons reduction and peace treaties and ceasefires, what's actually happening in the world today is very different from that. So we're going to talk about the cold, hard reality of today. The highest level of military spending worldwide in history was at the peak of World War II, 1944. Using inflation-adjusted U.S. dollars as your measurement, the world approached that all-time peak in 2011, and it has stayed at about that level ever since. What's happening here actually brings to mind another end-time prophecy, and one that will be fulfilled before the one in Isaiah. And this one is in Joel 3, where the battle cry is sounded, "Prepare war, wake up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears." We're going to survey several headlines from this past week that show some specifics about how nations are increasing their military spending. We're going to talk about a missile shield in Romania, a way that Iran could get a nuclear weapon. We're going to talk about how Germany is ramping up its military spending. But we're going to start in Russia and a new nuclear missile that it just announced called, of all things, the Satan 2. And for this story, we will turn to Andrew.
Yes, well, Russia's working on a enormous and quite shocking new intercontinental ballistic nuclear missile. Said they're calling it the RS-28 Sarmat intercontinental ballistic missile, though, as you've said, NATO's codenamed it the Son of Satan or Satan 2. According to Russian state media, it actually has the capability to wipe out parts of the Earth the size of Texas or France. Now, that is true in a manner of speaking and maybe not true in another manner of speaking. They're definitely kind of trying to play this up for dramatic effect. You know, it's 100,000 megaton intercontinental ballistic missile, got a range of about 6,000 miles. So if you'd launched it from Moscow, it could make it all the way to Texas. Able to carry a payload of about 10 tons, which would equal, depending on the size of the warhead they put on it, between 10 and 15 nuclear warheads at once. Each warhead you'd be able to put on this would have about 50 times the explosive power of the atomic bomb that hit Hiroshima and Nagasaki during World War II. Now, I think kind of one of the unique things about it is that each of these 10 to 15 nuclear bombs, once the intercontinental ballistic missile gets over its target, can spiral off and hit separate targets. So you could hit a dozen cities at once with 50 times the explosive power as hit Hiroshima. So that, in that effect, they'd say, if you're trying to validate this Russian state media claim, if they launched it from Moscow, this intercontinental could get to a suborbital position over Texas and then have 12 bombs spiral off and hit the 12 major cities in Texas simultaneously. And so in that manner, you could hit a dozen cities across an area the size of Texas or France, though it wouldn't actually like turn an entire state into a crater, which I think is how some people had been trying to interpret this Russian state media claim.
Now, it seems like during the height of the Cold War, when scientists were just testing increasingly higher-yield nuclear weapons, that was a real danger during that time, where they were just getting to these catastrophic, destructive power on a scale that was unlike anything we'd ever seen. It seems like it's been quite a long time since we've heard of that type of testing going on, that it's been more of this move toward lower yield, more tactical nuclear weapons. This is going in the opposite direction, and it seems really kind of at odds and really alarming compared to the trend that we've seen.
Right. Well, there definitely is kind of a divergence in the way they're looking at nuclear technology, especially in Russia, where they are still developing these lower yield tactical nuclear weapons. And there's an advantage there is that, there's a danger there in that some of these lower yield weapons, they're actually designing them to be used in conventional warfare. Because
right.
Normally the idea of the bigger missiles is that we're not ever supposed to use them. They're just supposed to scare your enemies to the point where they'll never attack you.
Right.
But so this is kind of, and they still are developing that. But this is, like I said, new really since the end of the Cold War, is going bigger. Because eventually it got to, I think both the United States and Russia have about 1,800 nuclear missiles on high alert, ready to be deployed. They have more than that in reserves that they could get up and running. But I mean, between these two arsenals, I mean, it's enough to kill everyone on the planet several times over. And so the idea was, is like, well, why would you need something bigger? I mean, if you can already destroy all life on the planet, there's not much of a need to develop these bigger weapons, except for, like I said, like propaganda purposes. The fact that Russian state media can actually get on there and brag now that they could destroy Texas or they could destroy France.
Well, you know, it's not hard to look at that and say, well, and you could see, say, politicians in the United States talking about this as if it's bluster. But if you view it in context of several of the other things that Vladimir Putin is doing and that Russia is doing strategically, it definitely seems like their policy is one of really flexing their muscles globally. And really, it's exactly this kind of behavior that makes other nations, and particularly European nations, Eastern European nations most of all, so nervous, and why they feel compelled to take concrete steps to defend themselves. We actually have another story this week that speaks to this. And for this, we will turn it over to our man in Britain, Richard.
The U.S. has officially opened their missile defense system in Romania. They certified it as operational on Thursday, and now they've begun work on another missile defense site in Poland. This is a greatly watered-down version of the missile defense system which the U.S. began under President Bush. Its declared reason for existence is to defend NATO members in Europe from attacks, a potential nuclear attack from Iran. Though, of course, Iran is our friend and ally, and the possibility of them launching an attack on a European nation is absolutely unthinkable. So that's the declared reason. Russia has kicked up a big, big fuss about this. Usually when Russia says something is directed at them, I think they're usually being paranoid and trying to score political points. And that may be the case this time, but it's also true. It's not really about Iran. It is all about Russia. Now, Russia claims that the missile shield would be capable, or they're worried that it's capable of shooting down their nuclear missiles. And so the fear that they are talking about right now is that if America knows that they can shoot down all of Russia's nuclear missiles, then America can nuke Russia and know that they can get away with it. And maybe they do genuinely believe that, or they're worried about secret things going on there. But really, they know that what is there is not significant enough to come anywhere close to being able to do that. So they're being a little disingenuous here as well. So what is the missile shield really about? It's a tripwire. You know, Eastern Europe wants a permanent U.S. military presence in their country. America's promised to defend them. They don't really trust that promise, and so they want some kind of guarantee. They want American forces on their territory so that if Russia invades, that would automatically put them in conflict with American soldiers. And these missile bases are an excuse for America to station forces in these other countries. So that's really what this is all about.
It's funny to hear Russia saying, well, we don't think that it's fair for you to be positioning this anti-missile defense system in Eastern Europe at the same time that it's announcing the Son of Satan 2 nuclear weapon. something not quite right about this.
Yes, and actually Brookings kind of, they had an article, the Brookings Institute, making this point, and they just talked about how for decades and decades, you know, the Soviet Union, they would just often say, oh, we're doing this as a response to something that NATO is doing, even though often Russia made that move before NATO made theirs. They will use anything they can as an excuse and say that they're doing it in response to NATO. And I think that's one of the significant parts of this story, is we'll now see Russia will take some kind of action, probably some action that they would have taken anyway, but it will be accompanied by a lot of rhetoric. And they'll say that they're doing it in response to these missiles in Eastern Europe. So you'll have perhaps the Satan 2 missile. They might characterize that. There's also been talks for a long time about putting the Iskander missile, which is their, like Andrew mentioned at the start, it's of his section, it's their tactical nuclear missile, much shorter range, much smaller yield. They may well put that in Kaliningrad or even in Crimea. So actually, whatever is going to happen, it will probably spook Europe, and especially Eastern Europe. And so you'll see calls for even more help from the rest of NATO within Eastern Europe, and it will just help ratchet up the tension there even further.
Yeah, and it's amazing how much ground they can get away with off even what would be probably considered a relatively minor NATO move. I mean, I think we talked about that last week on the show, where NATO positioned 4,000 troops in the Baltics, so Russia put 30,000 new troops on their area. Or NATO's talking about putting a relative or minor missile defense shield in Eastern Europe, so they come up with a new Son of Satan 2 missile that can wipe out 12 cities, each with a blast 50 times the size of the one that hit Japan in World War II. So it doesn't seem like it takes much of a NATO countermove to just elicit this like overwhelming response.
Right. It's also interesting that all of these things can be happening on the ground. You mentioned, I think it's a good point, the fact that they're saying we're putting this missile defense shield in place to prevent an Iranian attack, at the same time that they are going ahead with all of these diplomatic initiatives and economic initiatives. And it's almost the disparity between the words and the actions is jarring. And this is happening all over the place. You see similar kinds of diplomatic overtures being forged between, say, Germany and Russia. And they're talking as if things will work out fine and we're good friends and we can make these energy deals with one another and so on. And at the same time, they're preparing themselves and bracing themselves for the worst case scenario that could arise from this situation. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG, talking about this arms race of sorts going on between Europe and Russia. But we'd be remiss if we didn't include Iran in this discussion. A story this week shows that Iran could actually attain a nuclear bomb without making one itself. For this story, we're going to go to Jerusalem and to Brent.
Yeah, there was an interesting article this week in the National Interest, and it's in the Trumpet Weekly. It was written by Peter Brooks. He's a former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense of the United States. So it's coming from somebody that has a little bit of know-how in this area. And I'd just like to read the first couple of paragraphs of the article to you. He says, last summer's Iran nuclear deal has been roundly criticized for a number of solid reasons, ranging from Tehran's ability under the deal to continue advanced centrifuge research to lingering questions about the possible military dimensions of its nuclear program. That's all well established. Then he goes on to say, one issue that has been largely ignored is this. What if Iran were able to find a suitable partner to collude with on an underground nuclear weapons program, all the while seemingly staying within the restrictions of the July 2015 nuclear deal? In other words, Tehran could, by all public accounts, adhere to the deal, but concurrently, Iran could work clandestinely with another country to advance its nuclear weapons program, essentially circumventing the IAEA's inspections and monitoring of the nuclear program inside Iran. And then he says, what better candidate for covert cooperation than KG North Korea? So he says that it's possible that Iran, while they are obeying the strict letter of the law of the nuclear program as nuclear deal, as relates to their development of nuclear technology and nuclear weapons, they could be working things out with North Korea to maybe get a bomb from them.
We've actually talked about this before. I think even the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has talked about the fact that at these several of these North Korean nuclear tests that you've had Iranian scientists that have been present there, and there's obviously been quite a lot of collusion between these two powers. And what has the West done about that? This is really a major backdoor in the whole nuclear deal that the West made with Iran, and giving them the opportunity to do quite a lot of work on their own program, even on someone else's soil.
Yeah, for sure. And it does. We even have, like you say, the proof of collusion in the past with Iranians being over there. We even had that site in Syria and Damascus, that the nuclear facility that was developed by the North Koreans and then was destroyed by an Israeli airstrike in 2007. So they've already tried to build nuclear facilities in the Middle East, North Korea. We have also both Iran and North Korea agreeing that they have a common enemy in the United States as well. And we know that they've cooperated on ballistic missile technology in the past. So why wouldn't they? And it's definitely, why wouldn't Iran, if they have a friendly player and a friendly ally in North Korea who is developing nuclear weapons and who has had four, maybe even five nuclear tests in the past, or since 2006, the most recent being this year. While there is some discussion of how effective their nuclear weapons are, we know that they have definitely been developing a program, and they're much closer than even the Iranians were. We have to ask ourselves, why would the Iranians work so hard for 15 years to develop a nuclear weapon? We've proven that they were trying to develop a nuclear weapon. Even the UN said that. And then give it up all of a sudden if they didn't have another route to get it. Of course, we have, as part of the nuclear deal, there is a sunset clause in there that after 10 to 15 years, if Iran has been good, then they can proceed to develop more civilian uses of nuclear technology, and then, you know, the gloves could come off. But they're not waiting for that long. They wanted all the money, all the benefits, all the sanctions relief, and then possibly they were already arranging with North Korea. While we don't have direct proof of it, you could see that they would be arranging to have at least share nuclear abilities with North Korea at the same time.
Well, Europe has to be watching this, and maybe there is something to the claim that a defense shield in Eastern Europe would have some deterrent effect with respect to Iran. Certainly, anybody who's looking at the situation with clear eyes sees that an Iranian nuclear threat has to be considered. We're going to go back to Europe one more time before we go to the break. Another story about just European and particularly German response to the kinds of threats, the scale of the threats that we've been talking about to this point. And for that, we'll go back to Richard.
For the first time since the end of the Cold War, Germany is increasing the size of its army. The German Defense Minister Ursula von der Leyen, she said a quarter of a century of shrinking is over. It's time for the Bundeswehr to grow again. And so they'll be recruiting another 15,000 or so soldiers and another roughly 5,000 civilians. And I think there's two very significant things about this. An extra 20,000 people for the German army, that's not necessarily an earth-shattering development, but the fact that Germany has turned this corner after 25 years is very remarkable. So André Wunster, who's the head of the German Armed Forces Association, he says, not only is this not the trend, it actually represents a 180-degree turn in personnel policy. So we're seeing this complete turnaround. And again, Christian Mollinger, who works at the German Marshall Fund of the US, he said the personnel increase is not significant in itself, but there is a whole package of changes which add up to a large change for Germany. And so for them to turn this around, to change direction like this, is very significant. It shows us that there's a big change in thinking within the German army, within Germany, within how much they plan on using the army in the future. And they're already now involved in way more places, way more different locations than they have been in recent history. And that's really starting to put a strain on the army. So they're building up. And then the other thing I think is very significant here that's not been remarked upon so much is with this turnaround, they also plan on raising the upper limit on the size of the army. Now, the parliament has an upper limit on the size of the army of 185,000. They want to lift this ceiling. They don't plan on passing the ceiling yet, but they want to remove that so that they can plan to rapidly increase the size of the army at some point in the future if it's necessary. So they're also thinking at some point we may need to dramatically and very quickly expand our army, so let's put in place the legislation that we need to do that now.
And all of this is happening under an Angela Merkel administration.
Yes, though I wouldn't underestimate the amount of changes that have happened under Angela Merkel's administration within the military. She's not necessarily associated herself very strongly with that, but Karl Theodor zu Guttenberg ended conscription, and that was really just part of this push to turn the German army around from something designed to get as many men and bullets and guns going against the Russians as possible to a much more kind of leaner, meaner professional force that could go and invade other nations, that could get involved overseas in the Mediterranean, in North Africa, etc. And then Ursula von der Leyen has really built on a lot of that work. We've talked a lot about her reaching out and her partnership with other nations, and her and the Interior Minister, Thomas de Maizière, the President, Joachim Gauck, have really strongly made this case for a Germany that gets much more involved in international missions, and have followed through on that to a large extent. I mean, they've been 100 strong kind of missions, but there's still a very marked change for Germany. So there have been big changes taking place even under Angela Merkel.
Yeah, and I know some of the top generals in Germany have kind of been looking forward to this for a while. Last year, there was an article in Der Spiegel called The End of the Merkel Doctrine, just saying that Angela Merkel kind of really her defense doctrine's been more like that Germany doesn't fight much in foreign seas, but we sell weapons to other nations who will fight for us. So that, like, instead of sending troops to the Middle East, they'll build up the Saudi Arabian army, or they'll build up the Turkish army and have other nations kind of do the fighting, who are considered allies, do the fighting for them. And there have been a number of generals in Germany saying that's probably not going to – strategy is not going to work long term. Germany needs to start preparing for the day when they actually have to send Bundeswehr troops into these areas to secure their interest.
Quite a lot going on here. Very interesting to follow this global trend, really. Well, coming up, we're going to talk about a number of other important news items from this past week, including Britain's dying steel industry, how Europe's immigration crisis isn't going away, China's new pop culture icon, and a new warning that California may be about to experience the big one. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We're going to start this second segment by talking about British industry, specifically its steel industry. So in a way, this relates to the discussion about armaments in the last segment. And for this, we're going to go to Robert Morley.
Yeah, so there's been some news out of the UK just talking about the domestic steel industry and just how it is in really just dire straits. What's happening currently is that Chinese imports are just flooding the market, and British politicians have refused up to this point to protect local production, and thousands of people have been losing their jobs. And the Telegraph had a report on this titled "Steel Industry Suffers New Blow with More Job Cuts." And it says, it talks about how companies that have been in operation for even hundreds of years in Britain are now dying. They're being shut down. And they talked about thousands of jobs being lost in Redcar and Sheffield and all these places. And what I found particularly interesting about this was just how unconcerned Britain's politicians appear to be. Steel manufacturing is one of the most critical components of having a first world economy. It is one of the most critical components of a military industrial complex. Without steel manufacturing capability, a nation really does not have the ability to create the implements of war that are needed by modern society. And it really is just shocking that politicians would be allowing this to happen in this nation. Now, I think for a lot of years, politicians thought, okay, well, China is coming into our market, but they're just dealing with low-end, low-grade iron and things along that end. So it was kind of this situation where leaders were complacent about it. And at first, it didn't seem like a real threat. But since the collapse of the economy, the global economy in 2008, in ensuing years, China has just, instead of cutting back production, a lot of what's happened to these steel manufacturers have just produced flat out to try to, you know, get that little fraction of a margin. And they've just really been dumping in the UK. And this has had just a devastating effect. And this article brings out that now it has gone from the low-grade steel that China is now even pushing Britain on the high-end specialty steel products that they manufacture, the complex ones that are used in even high technology applications. And now politicians are maybe just beginning to be wondering, you know, is this something that we should be letting happen in the UK?
It's really one aspect of the broader trend. It's particularly stark viewed in contrast with everything that we were talking about in that first section, how so many of these nations are building up. And here Britain is doing exactly the opposite and really giving away the farm on some of these critical components.
Yeah, it is shocking. Ambrose Evans-Pritchard had an article a couple of weeks back, or maybe a month back, talking about why Britain might be doing it. And he theorized that it was because they had cut a deal with China. Basically, Britain was losing its nuclear industry and its steel industry, and it needed help to salvage its nuclear industry. And they had basically cut a deal and said, yeah, we'll let you into our markets, the steel industry markets, but you need to help work with us in saving our nuclear industry, our ability to build nuclear power plants and keep that technology in the UK.
Richard.
I think another side to illustrates, like you were saying, just how unconcerned Britain's leaders are about the steel industry. But look at who the big steel company that's in the news is. It's Tata Industries, the famous Indian company. And, you know, they've just, even with the domestic steel that's made in the UK, they've allowed that to be sold off to foreign companies. And now it's a foreign company based in India that is making a lot of these decisions about, do we close these steel plants? Do we fire the workers? And I think there is, like you said, there is some discussion in politics regarding, should we step in and try and do something because of the jobs? But there is absolutely, I've not seen anything from anyone that says this is a strategically important industry. We need to protect this.
Yeah, these are the kinds of ripple effects that don't tend to be included in the discussion. When they make these, there may be purely economic considerations, but those strategic considerations that really do have catastrophic long-term effects at times tend to be overlooked. Well, thanks for that story, Robert. Next, we have a couple of stories about what's happening with the immigration crisis, a story that we've followed closely for many months. But we're going to start by talking about Turkey. And to tell us about this, we'll go to Brent.
Yeah, this past week or last weekend, for the first time since the Syrian civil war began, we had Turkey officially sending some of its elite soldiers into Syrian territory, and they were going in there to attack Islamic State fighters who had been launching a lot of rockets into Turkey for the preceding weeks. They'd been hitting this town called Kilis of about 100,000 people, a town that was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize this past year because of how many Syrian refugees it's accepted, and a town where some of those Syrian refugees now are wondering whether it's safer to go back to Syria. Well, basically, the President Erdogan of Turkey had enough. He alerted both Russia and the United States that he was going to send ground forces into Syria to conduct this raid. And then over the weekend, he did, knocking out a lot of Islamic State targets, a lot of their launch pads as well, and then retreated back into Turkish territory. Now, it's important because it's pretty big when you have the Turkish army officially going into Syria. It's a massive army, the biggest. I think it's the biggest in the Middle East. I might be mistaken there. It is quite large, though. It comes at a very critical time with Turkey's relationship with the EU. Erdogan has asked for a lot of help and support from NATO, mainly made up of European nations and the United States, but they haven't really got too much help as far as defending their border goes. So on Thursday, the week, a few days after, just yesterday, after this mission, Erdogan suggested that he is even prepared to send more of his troops into Syria to stop the Islamic State.
So how does this affect things upstream? I know we've talked to you mentioned the relationship with Europe. If the immigration crisis continues to worsen, how does that affect Europe?
Right. Well, the immigration crisis has actually been stemmed for the time being, basically because Turkey decided to stop it. And that was a deal that was brokered between Angela Merkel specifically and other Europeans and President Erdogan. And we've talked a lot about this deal. Basically, it was if Turkey closes off the border to Greece, then Turkey gets $6 billion. And they also get a visa waiver for all Turkish citizens traveling into Europe. They could travel into Europe more freely. Now, over the past week, there has been a firestorm between Europe and Turkey over this deal. We had just this past week, it went back and forward because everybody sees that basically Erdogan is saying, hey, if you don't give us this visa waiver or free travel basically into Europe for our citizens, I have the controls on sending refugees to you once again. One of Erdogan's advisors, he tweeted to members of parliament in Europe, if they make the wrong decision, we'll send the refugees. So they're pretty much blackmailing Europe into getting this money and then also with the visa waiver issue as well. But Europe this week seems to be putting up a pretty strong fight themselves, at least rhetorically. We had Jean-Claude Juncker, the president of the EU Commission, he came back and said, we put a great value, he said, I think it was yesterday, we put a great value in the conditions being met. That is the conditions for this deal, which includes Turkey getting better on its human rights and also stop deeming every second journalist that preaches, that spins messages against the Erdogan regime a terrorist. Europe wants them to clamp down on that or stop that before they get this deal. And anyway, he said, Juncker now, he said, otherwise this deal, the agreement between the EU and Turkey, won't happen. If Mr. Erdogan decides to deny Turks the right to free travel to Europe, then he must explain this to the Turkish problem. It will not be my problem. It will be his problem. And it's kind of interesting to see them fighting back on this issue because, as I said before, Turkey holds a lot of the cards in this situation of whether or not Europe is flooded again with migrants.
Well, let's just hand the baton over to Richard, and you can give us more information about what's happening within Europe based on this this trend.
Right. I think the important thing to remember on this visa waiver issue is that each individual nation has a veto on it. So any one EU nation can stop it. And I think it's hugely unpopular within Europe. About the only nation that does want it is Germany. So it just boils down to, is Germany powerful enough to force every EU nation to sign up to this agreement with Turkey? And this time last year, the answer would have probably been yes, but Germany's star has fallen so far since then with Angela Merkel's handling of the immigration crisis that it seems unlikely that Germany would be able to do that. So I think this whole thing could be setting itself up for another outbreak of the immigration crisis. Maybe later down the line, other countries will be willing to sign up to giving Turkey a visa waiver. But at the moment, I think there's enough countries that don't want that that they'll probably stop it.
Other developments within Europe that speak mm-hmm. to this point, Richard?
Yeah, there's been a lot of news from Europe this week. Just as Brent said, the actual flood of immigrants may have slowed down, but the headlines and the events just pushed by the immigration crisis keep continuing. So Austria's chancellor, he had a kind of a shock resignation this week. People were expecting him to continue on into Austria's next election, which I think is in 2018 at the earliest. But his party did absolutely horribly in the presidential election. The two mainstream parties were almost wiped out. A far right, or a party that's usually considered far right, won that election and is now heading into the runoff, and Austria could have a president from this party. And so because of the appalling performance of his party, he stepped down. And that just shows, I think, the depth of the political turmoil and uncertainty that's going on within Austria. Now, they were able to rally around a new candidate pretty quickly. Not everyone thought they'd be able to do that. So the situation looks to be fairly stable right now. But if things continue, if the immigrants keep coming, you could have a very, very unstable situation within Austria. Then meanwhile, just north in Germany, you had a survey where nearly two-thirds of Germans said that they believe that Islam did not belong in Germany. That is remarkable just because of how quickly that has changed in just a few years. The German president, or a former German president, Christian Wulff, he said back in 2010 that Islam is now also a part of Germany. And when he said that, more Germans agreed with him than disagreed. That since then, though, has turned around, and you've got this overwhelming consensus that Islam is not a part of Germany. You'll see the Alternative for Deutschland party is taking a much more anti-Islam, not just anti-Islamic terrorism, but anti-Islam position. And then also this week, the Christian Social Union, this is the more conservative party in Bavaria, they're talking about breaking with Angela Merkel. Usually these two parties, they kind of run on a joint ticket. If you live in Bavaria, you vote for the CSU. If you live outside Bavaria, you vote for the CDU. They don't compete with each other. But this week they made some serious noises about perhaps having a separate manifesto to Angela Merkel. They're talking about perhaps going nationwide. So you could see a kind of more opposition on to the right of Angela Merkel. And if they did that, you could see them gaining in popularity much more quickly than the Alternative for Deutschland, because they don't kind of have this fringe right connotation with them, and they'd be much more acceptable to people in the mainstream who oppose Angela Merkel's handling of the immigration crisis.
There are a whole lot of people who are probably not particularly concerned about the particulars of politics in Europe, but we really can see how the climate is building toward the fulfillment of exactly many of the biblical prophecies that we talk about so often. I would say if anybody is interested in this subject more, that you really ought to go onto thetrumpet.com and check out under the literature tab the He Was Right booklet that we offer there for free. There's one of the first chapters of the booklet really talks about biblical prophecy for Europe and how the chaos that we see reigning there today isn't going to remain that way for very much longer because of the rise of a leader in that part of the world who will be able to unify that fractious continent and lead it toward the future. Well, we appreciate that, Richard. You're listening to the Trumpet Hour Week in Review. As Europe, the climate in Europe maybe is gearing up for more authoritarian leaders and really becoming more authoritarian in some ways. We've been following that same trend in China. We have a report on this from Andrew Miller.
Yes, well, Taylor Swift and Beyonce better sit up and take note, because there's a new pop icon on the world scene. An unlikely one, but Chinese President Xi Jinping. In his, I guess, latest hit single entitled How Should I Address You, which is topping the charts in China right now, it's got like a folksy, I watched it this morning, it's got like a folksy techno-pop feel to it, of these images of Xi Jinping visiting poor elderly people in rural areas of China and giving them food. That's what the title comes from, is How Should I Address You, where it's got this, like, this old Chinese woman singing about, it was like, how should I address you? You've come to my home despite the wind and despite the rain. But, and this is, then this isn't just like some sort of strange fan-made trailer like the Obama girl thing that came in America back in 2008. Apparently, the Chinese Communist Party has actually hired a consultancy firm in Britain run by an Egyptian who lives there named China Eye Ltd., which specializes in, like, publicity campaigns, where they just sit down with them, and I don't know how the conversation went. It was something like, hey, I'm Xi Jinping, and I'd like to start a cult of personality, so what would you recommend I do? And they're really just this is a government policy where they're looking at using social media and using pop songs to just really market the Chinese president as someone who's hip and cool for the Chinese youth.
So an Egyptian-British man advising a Chinese president.
It's a globalist world. But.
Well, thanks for that, Andrew. The last story that we're going to cover is really another quite different one. A major warning about a big earthquake that is likely on the horizon here. For this, we'll go back to Robert.
Yes, the director of the Southern California Earthquake Center, a man by the name of Thomas Jordan, issued a report this past week. It was picked up by several news agencies, got a lot of attention, and I found it very, very interesting, and I would say very sobering if what he says actually takes place. In this report, he said the San Andreas Fault, quote, looks like it is locked, loaded, and ready to go. So according to Jordan, the San Andreas Fault Line, that major fault line that runs through California, in particular, he's talking about the portion of it in Southern California. He says there has not been a major seismological event on that portion of the system since 1857. And he says this is very significant because it means that stress has been building up for a long time. And now we're at a point where it's getting to be a lot of stress on this very, very famous fault system. And he goes back through history and he talks about the various earthquakes that have struck California in the past. He talked about how it was a San Andreas Fault moving, sliding back in 1906 that basically destroyed the entire city of San Francisco. When that earthquake hit, it not only knocked down buildings, destroyed City Hall, but the fires that were ignited afterwards basically eviscerated the rest of that city. And he's saying that, yes, California has had earthquakes since then, in Southern California, but they have not been associated with the San Andreas. You know, the Northridge earthquake in 1994 was a different system. So he's warning, California needs to be prepared. The big one is on its way.
So, you know, I've been around long enough that I've heard a lot of the big one is coming in California for a long time. It's easy for people, once you become inured to that kind of a warning, to not take it all that seriously. Why is this more significant now, what we're hearing?
Well, as part of the study, they went ahead and put some odds. They tried to do some calculations on the probability of this happening, how soon this could happen. And it was very interesting. The scientists at part of the study looked at the probability of an 8.0 earthquake hitting along this strike. And an 8.0 is actually a pretty damaging event. It would be, they said, it would basically sever every single connection that transverses that fault line, every road, power line, internet cable, anything, oil pipeline, they'd all be severed across that. And they said that just looking at history and how often this happens and the length of time it's been since the last one, they suggest that the odds of an 8.0 quake striking within the next 30 years is about 7%. Now, that might seem like it's a little bit low, like 7% of an 8.0, but an 8.0 is a very large earthquake. They said the probability of a 7.0 to up to an 8.0 happening, the odds of that go up dramatically. They say the odds of that happening over the next 30 years is probably a 75% chance of that happening. So even with the 7.0 to an 8.0, I mean, that is something that would be extremely damaging to California.
Go ahead, Brent.
Yeah, I was just wondering, Rob, if you knew what the building code is in California. California expects these quakes, tremors that happen all the time. Isn't there like a government cap or anything? The buildings are made to withstand a 7.0, or do you know what that is, perchance?
Yeah, that's an absolutely great question. California does have some of the most strict building codes anywhere in the world outside of Japan. And this report did take a look at that and said that a lot of the buildings, the newer type buildings, are designed to withstand a 7.0 type quake, meaning they won't follow. The big skyscraper shouldn't completely collapse under 7.0. But they still said the damage that would be caused to these buildings, the cost to retrofit them, fix the damage, would be estimated at around $33 billion. And they said that was probably just the tip of the iceberg because the number of fires that would be started, the fires themselves would probably cause more damage than the actual earthquake itself of a 7.0 earthquake. Now, if there's an 8.0, that changes because those buildings in California with an 8.0, then it starts to question, you know, what exactly will happen to the structures.
Well, $33 billion. I think California's got enough money in the bank account to handle that type of thing. Well, we appreciate that, Robert. You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. We'd like to offer you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we're discussing on the program are in this report. We put it together, compile it every week, and deliver it to your email inbox, and it is absolutely free. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
That's some hip-hop happening, pop music from China. That's the new pop icon of China, Xi Jinping. How should I address you? Good stuff. All right, so we're going to go on to our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Andrew.
Yes, well, Queen Elizabeth II of Britain was not amused by the behavior of the Chinese delegation during Xi Jinping's recent visit to China. Apparently, the delegation actually walked out on the British ambassador over some disagreements they were having, and the Queen herself was caught on a mic afterward. I don't think she knew she was online, just commenting on how rude China's been and undiplomatic China was behaving during their recent delegation. So just more evidence that the Chinese government doesn't really care what any other nation thinks of them, even if you're the Queen.
Well, you ought to sing to her. Let's go now to Brent.
The Lebanese-based terrorist group Hezbollah's top military commander in Syria, known as Mustafa Bedreddin, was killed in a large explosion on Tuesday in Damascus. Reports indicate that the Israeli Air Force might have been behind the killing, as they've attempted to assassinate him before. Now, Bedreddin is a pretty bad guy. He was a master bomb maker whose expertise was used in the attacks on the U.S. and French military barracks in Beirut in 1983, which killed 305 people. And then a year later, he was personally supervising the bombing of the U.S. embassy in Kuwait, which killed 6 people. And then in 2005, he was one of the masterminds behind the assassination of the Lebanese Sunni leader Rafik Hariri in 2005. So he's a really, really bad character, and he has finally been killed in Syria, and we'll see if his death rattles Hezbollah's already fragile support base in Lebanon.
All right, thanks for that. It is a lightning round. Let's go over to Richard.
The European Commission, it seems like they might be about to put sanctions on Spain and Portugal for their governments borrowing too much money. That's according to Euractiv news website. And the EU, this would be the first time ever that the European Commission has placed sanctions on EU countries for this. Meanwhile, Italy's economy is looking increasingly troubled. There's a growing movement there to try and get them out of the euro. And so we could see the euro crisis back in the news over the summer from any one of those countries or more.
All right, now on to Robert.
The U.S. Treasury raked in a record $1.9 trillion in tax revenues from the first 7 months of this fiscal year. That's up about $14 billion over last year. So this record tax collection works out to more than $12,500 for every person who held a job in America. And this is what gets me. Despite the record haul, the federal government still ran a huge deficit, $350 billion of extra debt added during that time period.
All right, back to Andrew.
Yeah, so the Chinese military took a break from singing this Tuesday to scramble the two fighter jets from the U.S. Navy sailing through the South China Sea. The United States was sailing a ship through, trying to prove that they actually were still allowed to sail through the South China Sea when China scrambled the communications of the jets, saying that they were being provocative by entering those waters.
All right, let's go back to Brent.
The Islamic State Revolutionary Guard Corps threatened to drown any U.S. warships approaching Iran, a top general said on Tuesday. Quote, he said, "We have informed Americans that their presence in the Persian Gulf is an absolute evil," and then continued to say Americans are aware that Iran would destroy their warships if they take a wrong measure in the region. Now, these comments came just days before the United States Navy demoted the commander of 10 U.S. sailors who in January entered Iranian territorial waters and were briefly detained by the Iranians.
Richard, did you have another one?
I did. Angela Merkel is up for election next year in 2017. And a new poll published this week found that two-thirds of Germans do not want her to run again. Two-thirds want her to step down by the end of when her term expires in 2017. And so there's a growing movement now that Germans are ready to be rid of Ms. Merkel.
Andrew, you got a quick one?
Yes, Japanese president met with Vladimir Putin at a resort at the Black Sea this week to discuss lifting political sanctions and territory disputes over the Kuril Islands, which is actually another major snub against the United States, and that President Obama had really been asking him several times to please not meet with Putin due to our disagreements over Crimea.
All right, and we'll end with Robert.
Well, NASA added more than 1,200 new planets to the known galaxy list on Tuesday. That more than doubles the number of confirmed planets orbiting alien stars. The analysis was performed via the Kepler Space Telescope, which identified 4,300 potential planets. So for over 1,200 of those candidates, basically they had to have a 99% probability that they were actual planets. And NASA says for those that they added to the list, they are almost guaranteed to be planets.
Well, I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly, our weekly news report. The stories that we talk about are in this week's edition. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Robert Morley, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thanks for having me.
Great to be here.
Great to be here.
And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. I'll leave you with the words of Benjamin Disraeli. To be conscious that you are ignorant of the facts is a great step to knowledge. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.